This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You're listening to an iFanboy Special Edition podcast. I'm Josh, and today I'll be talking with writer B. Clay Moore. So I'm here with B. Clay Moore, a comic book writer of many, many, many things. How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Very good.
How about yourself?
I'm pretty good today. It's a very lovely day in New York City. Where are you right now?
I'm in suburban Kansas City.
Suburban Kansas City. Is it lovely there, or are you under threat from tornado?
This has been a pretty crazy tornado season, but we tend to just get the warnings and then kind of watch the footage of the little towns in Kansas that get crushed. But no, today's nice. It's in the mid-80s, so.
The reason that we are talking is because you posted a blog post, and it made your dog angry.
Hang on. There we go. He's done. Sorry.
No problem.
Yes, a blog post, yes.
About basically internet reviewers on creator-owned books.
I
posted sort of a response to that. So why don't you, in your words, tell me what you wrote and what it was about?
Well, in fairness, it's kind of the whole discussion kind of evolved from the initial post. And a couple weeks later, there's been a thread on my message board on the Image Comics site that has kind of continued the conversation. And it's almost hard to encapsulate what the initial point was, just because it's just a blog post that suddenly caught the attention of a lot of people. So I started hearing from, I heard from the Around Comics guys and John Suntress and all these guys, and everybody had their own interpretation of kind of what I was saying. The only point I was making, and one of the misconceptions about, people that have seen the original comment, was that I was responding or I was mad about a bad review of one of my books. The first thing I want to reiterate is that's not true at all. I mean, generally speaking, I think reviewers do tend to give indie and alternative comics a little more of a pass than mainstream comics. So in some sense, maybe it's not fair to attack the bad reviews. But what had gotten to me was a couple reviews I read of creator-owned books that it wasn't – the negative reviews were couched in absolute terms, sort of making value determinations. This is good, this is bad. And in generally really snarky tones, which the internet thrives on. And my first impression is just that I think that really adds to this sort of pervasive atmosphere of cynicism that just seems to be all over the internet and fandom. And, the most obvious place you see that is in the Newsarama talkback sections, which are just often depressing when guys are on there trying to, guys are on there trying to promote work that they've busted their tails on. And you've got, anonymous guys who have access to the internet just tearing them apart. And in a lot of ways, that's what most online reviewers are just guys with access to the internet. And my first the first thing that caught my eye, and it might have even been something you guys had posted about reviewing the Mark Millar Fantastic Four. I don't know if it was you guys or it was a podcast that I'd seen a little announcement to, and I just made the comment that I thought it was completely pointless to review Mark Millar's Fantastic Four in terms of trying to recommend it or not to people, because that's a book – I'm going to say 99.9% of the people who bought the book knew they were going to buy it when they heard it was announced. And so sometimes I wonder why when there's so much focus on mainstream reviews that I don't see how they could possibly influence buying decisions. I wonder often what the purpose of those reviews are.
Well, I mean, from our point of view, the reason, you know, for us, it's fun to sort of analyze those things when they come out. This is obviously Mark Millar does, you know, Fantastic Four with Brian Hitch, and it's a big deal book.
Sure.
I don't know if everybody buys it right away. I think that there are a lot of people out there who get curious about it, and that's where like shows like us or Around Comics or Comic Geek Speak or wherever, you know, A, it's fun to talk about. And it's one of those things that after it comes out, there's usually a lot of argument about whether it was any good or not.
Let me say this. I think podcasts are a great place for discussion of things like that. You know, if there's a general discussion, somebody enjoyed it, somebody didn't enjoy it, you've got give and take in that circumstance. I read these reviews, you know, posted reviews, and I always kind of wonder what the purpose of them are.
Do you mean like message board posts or like?
No. I mean like review columnists. Right. I mean like where you'll review something online. You know, I mean, that's fine. I can't criticize someone for reviewing something. My point is just most of the reviews you see online are about mainstream books that people are going to buy or they're not going to buy, regardless of what you tell them about the book. And in that instance, you know, I'm not sure what the real purpose is. And when I see creator-owned reviews of creator-owned books or small press books, what really gets to me is when I see a book that somebody decided to publish, somebody put their heart and soul into, that they are satisfied with and the publisher is satisfied with and some fans are going to enjoy. And then some snarky anonymous guy who has access to a website that may or may not got a lot of traffic dismisses it with, you know, maybe it's something that just isn't his cup of tea. And I have no problem in the world with someone saying, you know, this just didn't work for me. Here's what the book's about. It may work for you. Because it's going to work for somebody. So when I read a guy like Hannibal Taboo on CBR, you know, with his comics, first of all, he's got a designation that are comics that are good enough to read but not good enough to buy. Well, what does that mean? You know, that just that alone drives me crazy, because he's saying one of two things. Go to your shop, stand there and read it, or download it illegally and read it. But it's not worth your time to spend money on this on someone's work. You know, I mean, it's just – to me, there's just a whole kind of attitude that's reflected in these reviews that is overly dismissive of work that – may or may not appeal to you based on an aesthetic judgment you're making that doesn't have any basis in fact. It's just, you know, it's just an opinion based judgment.
But isn't it possible that a creator owned book or something like that can? I mean, you can review things semi objectively. I mean, you can there are you know, elements of storytelling and elements of making good comic books that, you know, I mean, for me, I'm thinking when you put a creator owned book out there, you're putting it into the world, you know, come hell or high water. And it's almost like it's kind of up to the audience to decide which reviewers they're going to give credence to.
Sure, absolutely. And it probably sounds elitist of me to assume that people who are reading reviews aren't smart enough to determine whether, you know, the review is of any use to them. But I tend to think, you know, a lot of these, I know some sites that get a lot of hits, and the reviews are just very dismissive and snarky and smart-assed and what have you. And I don't think anyone's reading those reviews to see what, you know, to get recommendations or to see positive reviews. I think there is this sort of schadenfreude where people just really enjoy seeing someone take it to someone who has maybe a higher profile than they think they deserve. Or, you know, I mean, there are books that I personally think are absolutely abysmal, but for me, they don't match my sensibilities. And I could sit there and I could say, well, the storytelling sucks, the anatomy sucks, the drawing sucks, or it's photo traced or whatever, and complain about it. But I also understand there's an audience out there for that. And so all it does is just introduces an element of negativity and cynicism if I go out there and trounce something and proclaim it a bad piece of work. You know what I'm saying?
But isn't that just a bad review?
You mean a bad review in terms of a badly written review?
I suppose. I mean, if it's coming off as
most of them are badly written.
This is true, but I mean, then it is the responsibility of the readers. And sure. when you're throwing work out there, I mean, I guess you'd have to deal with it.
Oh yeah. Well, and this is the other thing is I'm not overly. I mean, I guess if I read a bad review of one of my books, a book where somebody didn't like the book, you know, I'll be disappointed. But I want to know. I would like to know what about it didn't appeal to them personally. And very often I can read a bad review of one of my books and it doesn't bother me at all because I understand that this book wasn't for this person. You know, I mean, I write a lot of books. My creator-owned books are generally not for people who are completely devoted to big superhero epics, for instance. You know, I mean, Hawaiian Dick is a 50s noir detective story set in Hawaii. Well, if your frame of reference doesn't extend beyond you know, mutant superhero books or whatever, it's probably not your cup of tea. And I don't even want to read your review of the book because, you know, it doesn't add anything constructive from my point of view if somebody who the book was just completely not intended for rips it to shreds because he doesn't dig it. That's one of my points, you know.
But do you think that anybody who would probably give any credence to that kind of review probably wouldn't read the book anyway, and so you're not really any worse off than you were?
Well, no, I agree completely. I don't think reviews make one bit of difference in terms of buying or selling. And the only problem I have in that regard is just the fact that it adds this tone of negativity, which I really think – I mean, they're just – You know, and I went by your message board, and I was actually impressed by the tone of a lot of the messages. You know, you had done your editorial about my comment, and by the time I got there, there were 30-some comments. And, you know, there were some knee-jerk reactionary, you know, this guy's an idiot, you know. But there was also a lot of kind of, you know, thoughtful consideration of what you had said about what I had said. And so, you know, maybe I needed to spend more time finding the niches – on the internet where this cynicism and negativity doesn't take hold all the time.
Do you think maybe you ascribe the personality of your what you think is the average Newsarama poster to, you know, like the larger – I mean, because the person on the internet reading and writing about comic books is – you know, my first thought is that he's an evil little troll. But the fact is that's probably not everybody. Those are just the loudest people.
No, and that's why some companies don't pay a bit of attention to internet press, because what it has turned into to a large degree is a really easy access forum for bitter, angry people to rant. And people who are satisfied and happy with things don't feel like they need to throw their voice out there and prove something by telling everyone what they think, you know? So when some jerk is posting on Newsarama, well, I'm going to pass on this book. I mean, who cares if you're going to pass on a comic book? I mean, you know, what possible purpose could you have to let everyone know that you, who nobody, you know, you're just going to ignore this work? Well, that's fine, you know. Somebody who is going to pick it up and enjoy it is probably just going to go pick it up and enjoy it. You know, they don't feel the need to express themselves and let everyone know they're out there screaming into the void. So yeah, in that regard, it is easy to just sort of mistake the angry voices for some kind of a majority or large percentage of the readership when that's obviously not true.
Well, I mean, you know, and I can say from our experiences, I mean, our website and community and podcast and all this stuff are based strongly around review. And how it works is, I mean, we sort of set the tone by how reviews are. And we have every book that comes out any week, anybody can write a review on.
Right.
You know, and we found that, you know, people will take those. You know, they will buy books based on it, or they will, you know,
sure.
They will not buy books based on it too. And it's not, I mean, I've been forever impressed by the people who come to our website.
Yeah.
And some of the, even like, the Around Comics guys, I also, you know, cause I've been around their stuff too. Like they're thoughtful people, you know, but
right. Sure.
Even when you look at Image Comics or Oni, they're putting out a lot of product and
yes.
There is to me a need to, you know, say which one, you know, like, well, this one worked for me because of this, or this one didn't because of this, or, I mean, I feel like even though they are creator-owned books, they're susceptible to the same amount of criticism as anything else. And granted, it is not as much fun as bashing on a huge book that came out from Marvel that wasn't
See, that's
good.
It right there. It's fun, see? and my point about Hawaiian Dick, and I made the mistake of saying it was above negative criticism. What I meant by that was, you know, I'll take constructive criticism and put it into the, you know, put it into the mix and consider it. But I don't want to. But if you tell me that the book is bad, I you're wrong because the book did what I wanted the book to do. The readers who relate to the book, you know, enjoy the book well enough. And you know, and I'm also not out here trying to. I'm not looking to capture 50,000 readers with this book. I couldn't do the good book I wanted to do and try to capture 50,000 readers. In comics, I mean, I think there's a bigger audience for Hawaiian Dick in the world at large than there is for Final Crisis. But people don't know where to find comic books. Right. They don't know they exist, you know, so that's a whole different discussion. But I guess that's the thing is you get a little disheartened when you hear people dismiss things based on their own personal criteria and ascribe value judgments, which is the good, bad scale. You know, this art is bad. This art is good. I mean, I see artists who I think are just phenomenal, who the art community that I hang out with think are phenomenal, you know, dismissed out of hand by guys who just trace photographs all the time, you know, and it gets really frustrating to hear them place these good, bad value judgments on it instead of just saying, you know what, here's why this doesn't appeal to me. And obviously the consideration there is just the fact that so many of these reviews are either not well written or, you know, aren't really guiding people. They're just sort of, you know, expressing a thumbs up or thumbs down personal mm-hmm. opinion as fact.
So do you think that there's a place for comic reviews on the web?
Sure. But I do think – I mean, yeah. If it was a perfect world, and it's not, and that's the other thing. I mean, I need to – obviously, I need to understand that most people reading comics don't read any Image comics. They don't read any Oni comics. They don't read any Slave Labor, Drawn in Quarterly. Most comic – readers don't read any books by anyone but Marvel and DC. I mean, a huge percentage of comic readers only read those books. That's something I don't think a lot of people even think about. So, you know, maybe my problem is that I'm expecting the streams to cross more than they should, you know. If a guy goes and spends $50 a week on Marvel and DC comics, is it really going to do any good to start telling him about you know, a book, a slice of life book from Drawn in Quarterly or a horror comic from Image. I would like to think that most readers of independent comics got their feet wet in mainstream comics and then crossed over, and I'd like to see more of that. So
there's definitely, I mean, again, like our experience is there's definitely, I mean, because one of the things that we try to do is we, you know, we're all superhero comic book readers. We read them, they come out, whatever. But, you know, I can tell you from there, we got a lot of people to read Invincible. And then a lot of those people read The Walking Dead. And then all of a sudden, they're on to reading stuff from Top Shelf and things like that.
I'd like to think that's how it works.
You've just got to find a way to do it.
Yeah.
Basically, I want more people to watch our show.
But if you're doing a review and you review Final Crisis and Civil War Invasion Scroll Fest, whatever, and Flash and blah blah blah. I mean, I can't sit here and criticize you guys for focusing on what you dig and what you think your readership digs. Obviously, I would love to see. I think it does more good for the industry if people spend more time reviewing stuff that sells 3,500 copies or 4,000 copies. That's every bit as good as something selling 75,000 copies in terms of the enjoyment that somebody could get out of the book.
But that's not really the point. I mean, the point isn't to try to sell books. It's to try to help people discern one way or the other. It's to find.
Well, I think the point should
help people find good comics. And for me, I've got to say, you know, a comic book is a comic book is a comic book. In a way, that's true. I mean, you know, a lot of the guys who are working on indie books, you know, you yourself, you're doing books for DC, you know.
Yeah.
You know, a good story is a good story, I guess. So, you know, in that way, everything is sort of equal. The sales, you know, the market being different, you know, a different sort of a different issue.
Sure. I mean, theoretically. What have you posted reviews on your site recently or I mean, you know, do you have on your front page, don't you have like reviews on your front page there?
Oh, user reviews are featured on the front page.
Okay, user reviews, okay.
And so, yeah. I mean, what it is it works, you go to ifanboy.com/comics. Right. I'm totally not trying to advertise the site right now.
No, I don't want to pull it up on my computer because I don't want to screw up my connection here.
If you go on there, anybody can pull a book and then you can write a review or rate that book. Yeah. You know, for any book, so that everything comes out. I mean, obviously, most of them are going to be, you know, the Marvel DC books, because the other thing is those are the ones that people have a probably more passionate connection to.
Right, because at this point in time, it seems like the overwhelming majority of the readership is only concerned with a book that's going to have earth-shattering impact on the universe at large, which is a whole different issue. But, you know, as someone who doesn't have a whole lot of interest in writing those books, it does get a little frustrating because you realize that in reality, I mean, obviously everything's subjective, but a really badly written and drawn event book is going to do triple the sales of what you think is a really well drawn and written, say, smaller superhero book.
How's that different than any other media, in movies or whatever?
Yeah. Well, the difference is that in other media, the pie is so much larger that it's possible to make a dent with a smaller – I mean, so a movie like Juno, whether you love the movie or not, as a comic book, that would die a slow and painful death. You know, that would sell about 1,500 copies, maybe get an Eisner nomination and have the publisher doing their best to sell it to bookstores because the comic book market had ignored it. But there's always the potential in other media for a breakout hit. Cable television, you know, HBO shows, those would die as comic books. Scalped is probably as good a comic book as there is in the market right now. The last sales figures I saw had it hovering around 7,500 copies. Well, if you put the equivalent of that on a network like HBO, it's going to sell, you know, it's going to be viewed by, you know, a pretty large viewership. It's going to win industry awards. It's going to sell a ton of DVDs. So there is a difference, I think.
I mean, it's scalable. I mean, if you look at like sort of the
it is scalable. I understand it's scalable. I mean, yeah, but
the risk that you have in putting out a comic book is much less than the one that you know you're hiring a crew and I'm buying film or whatever. I mean, it's all relative.
Well, in terms of, I mean, you say that, but I'm not sure that's necessarily true. If you're Jason Aaron and you're spending, your time and effort putting together. Spending 2 weeks out of the month, say, putting together a book that's not going to bring you a return commensurate with, say, the quality or the effort you've put into, then it is a risk. You know,
right.
I mean, it's a much bigger risk for the individuals involved than it is for people throwing crap on TV and moving on to the next project.
I mean, that to me seems like it's the same in any sort of media. There's the mainstream stuff that's the biggest. You know, the biggest thing on TV is Dancing
right.
with Whoever. You know where.
What about a show like Lost? You know, I mean, it's hard for me to believe something equivalent. You know, you look at the most successful shows on television, and you know, prior to something like the arrival of Lost, and then you throw a complete, a different animal into the mix in a show like Lost, and it turns into a huge success. It's hard to find any example similar to that in comics.
Well, I mean, the success doesn't have to be as big, but I can tell you, you know, personally, I've met guys who do indie comics. They've never done a mainstream book in their life, and they're doing
really
well.
Where have you found these people?
It is not my place to say. But, like, it seems like there's this certain level you can get to, and all of a sudden you're making a living, and you're talking to a guy who puts out a book six times a year, and it's a creator-owned book, and he's making a living from that, and he's doing the thing he loves, and, you know, it's possible.
Yeah, it is possible, but it doesn't happen very often. But again, there's nobody to blame for that. It's just that's part of a larger discussion about the fact that the market is shrinking, and when it's not shrinking, it's expanding into a mainstream direction. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, and it's not fair. I don't want to sit here and pretend like I'm not attacking readers or reviewers or anybody like that. There's a larger problem in terms of the entire market that doesn't allow for creator-owned books to gain a foothold. And people will say, you know, retailers will say, and fans will say, well, it's up to you as the creator to figure out how to make that happen. And that's probably fair comment in an era when. A good independent book is lucky to sell 5,000 copies. The Invincible and The Walking Dead are great examples, but those are the rarest examples in all of comics. Mm-hmm. The Walking Dead is a completely singular animal. There's nothing else comparable to what The Walking Dead has done. And now, when I was working for Image full-time and as an Image creator, we spent a whole lot of time going, geez, how can we do what The Walking Dead did? And there's really no way to quantify the formula and make it work, obviously, or else everybody would be doing it.
Maybe it's just harder to make an independent, successful comic. I mean, like,
you have
all of the things that get together. And
yeah. The Walking Dead is a fascinating – I mean, that I don't even think people understand what a phenomenon The Walking Dead is. And in terms of – in equivalent terms, that's a much larger success than anything like Final Crisis or Civil
right.
War or that, just because of where it started, you know. Mm-hmm.
And you don't have – I mean, I can't imagine there's a whole lot of overhead it's like when that book starts to do well,
right.
Everybody's happy because there's not that many people involved.
Right. And ideally, I mean, that's the perfect image model right there. You know, you own your material, you make the money off it if it sells, and there's a book that sells over 20,000 copies every month. They've sold about 100,000 copies of the first trade. And if you look at the top 100 trades every month, the first trade will be on there. It's a self-sustaining product. You know, that's what you want to get to. It's just, it's a long haul. You know, it's hard to do. And full credit to Kirkman for making it work and then going over to Marvel and making sure that he still had The Walking Dead and Invincible working and everything. So that's the other thing I think we need to see more of. And again, you know, you can't really blame creators for doing anything that's going to bring them success. But it's nice to see a guy like Robert make sure that he wasn't going to lose touch with his Image roots and his own material when he went over to Marvel and started doing books over there. I think too often we see guys have a lot of success in the mainstream, and as readers, I feel like we lose out when guys turn their entire focus to Spider-Man or Superman or, you know, whatever. Because I always believe that the best work from a really talented creator is almost always going to be something of his own conception above a superhero book. That's not to say there aren't great superhero books out there, but like I'm always going to prefer Matt Fraction's Casanova over what I think is a fantastic job on Iron Man or Iron Fist with Brubaker. So Matt is sacrificing to make sure that he can keep doing Casanova because I think he gets his, you know, he satisfies his creative Jones doing that book, and it's almost too much to ask him to keep doing that if it's not making him money when he's doing something else. But I just appreciate the fact that he, you know, he still places enough value on his own material to do that. Warren Ellis, another great example.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, he's a guy who really, like, his love – I love the stuff that he does on his own.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, to be honest, a lot of the stuff that he does for the companies, I'm like, there's no love in this. I can't – you know, I can't – it's not there.
And Bendis clearly loves what he started doing. You know, he'd done his own thing for a while, and granted, he did keep Powers going, but he clearly has the love for the – I can't begrudge Bendis for throwing himself into the superhero books because he clearly loves doing those books.
And he would be my example of a guy who going into mainstream, like, is just putting everything into that as well.
Right.
I don't think there's anything better than Powers, but he's come close, I think.
Sure.
You know, his Ultimate Spider-Man work.
Yeah. Well, Warren is the – kind of the – for me is the is the flagship creator in terms of the way I would love to see more guys handle their careers and the way I would try to pattern my own career after on a much, much smaller level at this point. But, you know, he'll do some I think his creator or his superhero stuff and his company stuff it's always a little more inventive than the norm, and sometimes it's really effective stuff. But he has never abandoned, you know, the third stream, you know, the independent stuff and stuff like Fell, which I think is as good as anything Marvel or DC does. Yeah. I just admire that, and I think it shows that it can be done, and you can still be successful without having to sacrifice, you know, all of your creative juices or whatever. Mm-hmm. Something like
that. Do you think that overall, I mean, the internet has to be helpful on the whole to an indie, to a creator-owned book. I mean, it has to be better than it was without it. You were at Image when Walking Dead was taking off. I mean, I can't imagine that sort of the word of mouth on something could spread like that, you know.
Yeah, you know, though, I'm not – I think you think that, but, you know, I mean, I guess so. But you tend to see the internet react to success rather than create success. I think that's it's like it's like the book market. That's a bad analogy, but – I was going to say that, you know, the book market knows what they want, and they'll promote and respond to something that's already a success in a different market. They don't create a lot of successes on their own. Well, I think to a large degree, you know, the first Walking Dead issue probably solicited around 7,500 copies or something, and it sold out, and there was a lot of good word of mouth. But most of the good word of mouth, I think, was at the ground level. You know, a store would sell all 10 copies they bought. And it's there, and all they're concerned about, all the retailer's concerned about, is what his customers are interested in. He doesn't care what some guy in Provo, Utah, is talking about if he's in Miami, you know. Mm-hmm. So he sells 10 copies. You know, he's hand sold it. His readers have enjoyed it, and he reorders the book. And if the book has caught the right zeitgeist or whatever, and has attracted the right attention, then that's going to happen all over the place. And really, I think that's what happens more than the internet spreading the word.
I think that brush fire starts on the internet, at least to some extent.
I think less than you think. I think in the case of The Walking Dead, I don't think so. I mean,
what did the internet do to you?
No, the internet's been great. You know, I spend way too much time on the internet arguing and promoting and complaining about reviewers and then posting good reviews. I mean, you know, I'm I handled PR for Image for a year, and I spent a ton of time trying to work the internet for for what it's worth. I'm just saying, ultimately, we're talking about something that people take away from a computer and sit with on their lap or in the bathroom and read. And then they go into their shop where they had to buy it and talk to them about it. And that's where it has to succeed. We can't just have stuff we can't talk about how great stuff is and increase sales, because you'll see a ton of stuff get a lot of coverage on the internet and great reviews. And then you go look at the numbers and you're like, wow, there's absolutely no real world reaction to the buzz this thing is getting online. And retailers, and it's because retailers aren't going to order stuff based on anything other than what they can sell in their shops to their existing customers. So,
I feel like indie comics especially, or even all comics, are just, they're beholden to this weird system of ordering 3 months ahead of time, and you know, what matters. And it's just like, everything is just,
yeah, well, that's the distribution system. There's that's another discussion.
But it's like, just that's one more thing. You know, I go into my local store here. You know, I'm in New York City, but I live in Queens. So I go into that local store. I'm like, do you have Fear Agent? No one buys it. And I was like, seriously?
Well, of course, no one buys it if you don't have it.
I know, exactly. Well, I had it for a while. But, like, so there's still those kind of retailers are the same thing as a bad kind of internet reviewer, I suppose. It's just.
But on the flip side, again, and trust me, I've had great relationships with retailers and horrible relationships with retailers. And and I've probably, you know, I'm too hard on guys who are really ultimately only responsible to themselves. You know, that's the problem, is that if a retailer can sell 50 copies of, you know, whatever Death Wish Final Crisis comic book comes out, and they know they can do that, well, they're going to put 50 copies on the shelf. If they know that they have to bust their tail to sell 5 copies of Fear Agent, well, why not just order an extra 5 copies of Final Crisis? You know what I'm saying? I mean, I can understand the thinking in a lot of regards, especially with so much material out there. It's hard to grab a retailer by the throat and say, look, this is a great book you're not selling, when he's got to worry about selling 200 other books that month, you know? So in that regard, you know, a lot of it's just down to the way the system works, and the distribution system we have now is what we have. So you either have to figure out how to make it work or get out of the business. I mean, as a creator, as a reader. I mean, where I draw exception is when people can't find books at their shops, and a lot of retailers have a real resistance to people, like to creators promoting online sales and things like that. Well, most communities are not serviced by a good comic book shop in this country. And people in New York and people in Los Angeles, people in San Francisco, Chicago, they don't understand this. But there are cities with 300,000, 500,000 people that don't have comic shop access. Or if they do, it's not a guy who's tuned in or who's going to reorder stuff or what have you. I think retailers too often think you're trying to circumvent the existing system when you try to find new channels of distribution. But the fact of the matter is, most people in America couldn't just go 5 minutes away and pick up Hawaiian Dick or Fear Agent or what have you. So the only other option is to try to generate sales through other avenues. And I personally believe that the more we sell stuff in other avenues, the more it helps comic shops. So.
I mean, the easiest thing to do for people would be to get up and go to the local comic shop. If that's not a good option, then why not find a different way? So, the thing is, they kind of
The problem is the industry tears itself apart with all these discussions, and there's no, you know, everybody talks about partnership, but everybody also thinks everybody else is out to stab them in the back in the name of making money, what have you. So there's a lot of animosity at the retail, and I'm not blaming retailers for this. I'm saying between publishers, retailers, and the lines of communication, you know, if people just, if you're a creator and you, or a publisher, and you have the chance to open dialogues with guys that you think are doing their job effectively in terms of retailing, then spend a whole lot of time talking to those guys a whole lot. And don't let the guys who attack you for the way you market yourself or handle yourself determine everything you do. The one lesson I learned as the PR head at Image was the best guys in retailing who knew what they were doing, did great business, sold good books, weren't the guys you heard the most noise out of online or here or there because they were too busy doing their jobs. So the one thing I did do was forge some good relationships with guys that I've taken into my – as a creator, I can ask these guys questions. I can lean on them for advice. The recently deceased Roy Root is a great example of that. I think communication throughout the industry is the key to helping everything improve. And I know we've traveled way off topic here, but it's all kind of related, I guess.
Yeah, it totally is. And you know, that's it's all about trying to find a way to get more people to buy Scalped, really, at the end of the day.
Well, yeah, do you read Scalped?
Scalped was the pick of the week this last week.
Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah, no, we've definitely been on it.
Jason's one of the – we've got a pretty good community of creators in Kansas City, and so Jason Aaron is one of our – he's one of our Kansas City guys. What Tony Moore refers to as the Midwest Mafia here in Kansas City. So
yeah, that's
Fraction.
Cool.
Fraction. No, it's not. That's Tony, though. But it's Tony Moore, Matt Fraction, Jason Aaron. There's Harold Sipe and Hector Casanova called Screamland at Image now. That's fantastic. They're local guys. Jeremy Hahn is just down the road. Jai Nitz is in Lawrence. Andy Parks is out here. So we've got a good community here in Kansas City.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, your first work was I guess Hawaiian Dick, first pro work published in 2000.
It was my first. Prior to that, the only thing the way I kind of got into the industry is. Jay Torres was a friend of mine, mm-hmm. and he was – at the time, he had done a book called Copybook Tales at Slave Labor Graphics and was pitching them an anthology called Love in Tights, which was a superhero romance anthology using independent creators. And he had asked me about contributing to it, and somehow I ended up basically editing the book, which at the time – this would have been like 98, 99 – meant – tracking down independent creators to get work in on time in whatever file formats they could give me, which even though it was only, 9 years ago or whatever, things were not nearly as uniform and there weren't, it wasn't as easy to share. So I'd get photocopies, I'd get, zip files, I'd get zip discs and what have you. And so we did we did 6 issues of that in about a year and a half. Didn't sell much, but it did sort of open the door in terms of, I could see how the industry worked, and then I watched Jay start working with Image and Oni, and I got to know those guys. So I did Hawaiian Dick kind of. I already kind of knew how the business worked when I got in with Hawaiian Dick. But
what were you doing before that? Where did you come from?
I was I was actually working in sales, and I was a journalism major in college, and never. And just knew I didn't want to handle journalism and came out, in the mid-90s, it was hard enough to find a job doing anything. So I took a job doing sales and spent all my time at work just kind of writing for fun, writing for fanzines. Mm-hmm. And Jay and I got to know each other through an APA, which barely exists anymore. But basically, it's a collective of fanzine fans, bi-monthly, and a few different people kind of rolled through. Actually, Jeremy Hahn, who I've collaborated with a bunch, a couple years after I left the APA, joined as a fan, and I got to know a few people that way. Jay Torres and I kind of got to know that way. We got to become closer at conventions and stuff, and as he was kind of working his way in, he always knew that he wanted to do this, mm-hmm. and I hadn't... I hadn't pursued it. I had been into comic strips. I did a comic strip in college. I'd thought about trying to pursue that. And, Jay was the first guy to ever say, well, have you ever thought about, like when I was complaining about money at a job or doing this or how much I hated selling food or whatever, he said, well, have you ever considered writing comics for a living? Which I know a lot of people, it just sounds like, well, sure, but, it was the first time I thought, well, shit, I guess there's a way to pursue it. And early on, I kind of had my own. I knew that, like with Hawaiian Dick, I wanted to do. I wanted to take my time and put together what I thought was really cool, mm-hmm. and not consider in any regard the marketplace or what was hot or what was popular. And I thought that would be the best entree into kind of the industry at large. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, it turned out exactly that way. Stephen Griffin and I spent time putting the book together and. Sold fairly well right off the bat. Sales have decreased since then because of the market and because we could never get the book out on time. But it made a splash, I mean, Stephen was nominated for industry awards right off the bat. The book got a lot of coverage in places like Entertainment Weekly and, we've been covered in the New York Times. And before the book was even out, I had Hollywood producers calling me and stuff. So I developed a relationship with Eric Stevenson at Image. Based on his love of the book, and just kind of found myself in the thick of everything with doors open here. And that's why I always give people that advice, instead of trying to calculate and figure out what people want to see, if you really have creative vision, do your own thing. And, that's ultimately what I think is going to convince people you can work in the industry. Casanova is a great example of that with Fraction. That's not a book that is going to appeal to everybody, but most people that saw that book recognized – the spark of creativity and intellect that Matt had, and that I think helped lead to everything else. So, there's your long answer to a short question.
No, it's I mean, like, you know, it's no secret that of all the people who aren't bad internet reviewers, the rest of them all want to be comic book creators.
Right, and that's also why there are a lot of bad reviews, is because there's a whole lot of, man, I could do better than this out there. But
no, totally. So, what point did you like quit your day job and say this is what I'm doing, or was that when you?
Well, Hawaiian Dick came out at the end of 2002, and I actually, it's a long story, but I was doing a job while I was talking to Eric Stevenson, and we had talked about self-publishing some books and promoting them differently on our own, and even though he was working as he was the marketing coordinator at Image at the time. And then Eric Larson replaced Jim Valentino as publisher, and Eric went from marketing coordinator to executive director. Eric Stevenson is basically the guy that runs Image Comics. And he called me up and asked if I wanted to handle the PR from Kansas City while they were out in Orange, just because he'd seen the way I promoted Hawaiian Dick, and we'd always kind of bounced ideas back and forth. And so I did. And so I spent a year working from home, handling PR and marketing while I was writing comics for Image, and it was hard to work that out. You know, there's a difference in time zone. There's, you know, I couldn't be face to face with Eric Larson ever, which I kind of needed to be. I couldn't afford. They moved from Orange to San Francisco, so that didn't help my. You know, I knew I wasn't going to move out to San Francisco and move into a shoebox. So eventually, I just. I guess at that point I went completely freelance. I'd made some money on optioning Hawaiian Dick, and we re-optioned Hawaiian Dick. Then Jeremy and I optioned The Leading Man, and so that was kind of seed money for a while. And, you know, in these days I'm writing – I'm doing something for Top Cow right now. I'm doing a couple things for Wildstorm. I just did some DC stuff. I've got stuff circulating in Hollywood. So it's – you know, it's not the most secure – profession in the world. I mean, you know, I can say if no more projects come in right now, then this is how many months I have before I'm on the welfare line. But you know, you just have to have faith that things are going to keep working out, and you keep plugging away and keep pitching. And
I believe Rick Remender was talking to us. He called it the fear.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Rick's the express. I don't know what the language quotient is in the show, but Rick would call me up just
say whatever.
He would just call me up over the top, and he'd be like, "We are grown ass men. What are we doing with our lives?" And he's like, "I'm married now. You've got kids." And I'd be like, "I hear you, Rick." You know, I'd get these fist in the air, pumping phone calls from Rick periodically. Although now he's, you know, and Rick's doing fine now.
I'm seeing him Twitter about puppies. So clearly he's been domesticated.
Yeah, I know. I saw that. That's horrifying. Rick's a guy I'd expect to throw puppies under a bus, but
Rick's, what he wants you to think.
I know. He's the rebel without a cause. And Rick's a good example. That's a guy who, you know, just through sheer determination and hard work has put himself in a pretty good position. Mm-hmm. And he's also got some talent, which helps. But that's secondary to everything else. So.
Oh, certainly.
But yeah, the fear, exactly. You know, where's my next? Well, I remember talking to Kirkman one time about when he signed his Marvel exclusive, and he's riding high on The Walking Dead and Invincible, and he's got, you know, all this stuff coming out, and he was talking about screenwriting because it was publicized that when Invincible was optioned, he was signed to handle the screenplay, and I said, "Is that something you want to get into?" And he's like, "Well, hell, in 10 years, what am I going to be doing with myself? You know, I got to be doing something, and I don't want to be begging to write the Hulk." And I thought, yeah, well, it's good to be prepared, I guess. So
that's a damn fine Kirkman, by the way.
Thank you.
Have you been holding on to that?
No. I'm renowned for my Kirkman.
Wow.
Well, I used to talk to him on the phone all the time, so I had it in my ear, you know.
Damn,
Roberts.
He's been on our show like more than anybody on a video show, and so I was just like, whoa, that brought me back.
Robert was also instrumental in a lot of ways in me kind of figuring out where I was headed, just because Robert's a guy who figured out how to work the system when he was about 19 years old, and in terms of marketing and this and that, and he would, you know, when I was at Image, he'd say things like he had an idea. What if I solicited an issue? What if I shipped an issue of Invincible without soliciting it? You know, and I'm like, that is just the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. He's like, I'm going to see what they say about it, you know. And he'd have enough balls to throw stuff at the wall like that. And, you know, the Walking Dead story is a great one where he had pitched the book and it wasn't picked up. And Jim Valentino was the publisher. And he had pitched it with – I got a call from Eric Stevenson after the book came out. He goes, yeah, have you read The Walking Dead? And I said, yeah, it's pretty good, first issue. And Eric's like, yeah, Robert had pitched this as there's a big alien invasion that's responsible for the zombie virus, because – Jim Valentino was like, well, it's just a zombie book at that time. Mm-hmm. And so Eric said, so I called Robert up and I said, hey, the first issue's great. Are there any hints about the aliens coming? And Robert said, there are no aliens. He said, what do you mean? He goes, man, I just had to tell him something to get the book picked up. I was like, that's a guy who's always thinking, you know. So yeah, for a long time I'd come up with what I thought were harebrained schemes, and I'd drop Robert a line and I'd be like, does this sound completely cracked to you? And he'd usually have pretty good advice. I mean, you know, he's just doing it a wing and a prayer, but, you know, he at least always had the guts to kind of take a chance on things. So.
It's working out.
He's doing just fine.
It's working out fine for him. He's going to be all right, I think.
It's one of the Image alumnus that we can be proud of. So,
wow, that's kind of, you were there at a pretty cool time. I mean, I'm sure you're still involved, but that's neat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why Robert and I came on board right around the same time. So when I first met him, I offered him copies of Wine Dick. He said, no, man, I buy the good stuff. I was like, oh, well, that's flattering. Thanks, Robert. Can I have your book now? But, anyway, and Remender's the same way. You know, we all kind of kicked around learning the ropes through Image. So.
Yeah, it's all these sort of names that started popping up 3-4 years ago, you know, more and more frequently, which is cool, I think. I like that there's a whole crop of guys who sort of exist between those two levels. Like, you guys will all go on and do mainstream stuff, but, you know, Rick's got stuff all over the place. You've got stuff, you know, in all different ways, and that's fun. I mean,
The main thing is we all just wanted to do – like, we wanted to none of us came on board and said, man, I can't wait to write the X-Men. Mm-hmm. And whether that happens or not, I think we all just kind of wanted to make comics and kind of tell our own stories. And that's why I like seeing the fact that guys like Rick and Robert are still – doing their own thing while they're making inroads in the mainstream, you know. So
what you got, like a whole crap ton of projects then going on. I don't know how you have time to talk to me or blog on the internet about reviewers, but
yeah, I pretty much, my writing is pretty much just marathon writing sessions when the baby goes to sleep and I spend all night trying to hit a deadline. But yeah, I've got you know, like I said, Hawaiian Dick is, we're trying to figure out what we're going to do long term with Hawaiian Dick. That's the book that I get the most satisfaction out of, and it's kind of my personal, you know, my baby, so to speak.
Have you got it planned out for a good long while after this one, or?
Yeah, but you know, the issue is it's really tough for Stephen Griffin to handle all the art on the book, so we had him scale back. Mm-hmm. And Scott Chantler drew this first story arc with Stephen handling the color. And then Stephen decided that he was going to also do a backup story that he was going to write, draw, color, letter, ink himself, and do the cover. So our plan to kind of have him take it easy didn't quite work out. So, but the way I feel about it is, at this point, I mean, people, I think, understand that, you know, we've tried. We've done everything we could to get the book out on time and to get stuff done ahead of schedule. But we continue to fall behind. And there's a part of me, I think the readership has kind of gotten to a point where they understand that if they're a fan of the book, they may wait for it. As much as I hate not to be able to turn out the product on a regular monthly basis, I ultimately, like, I want Steven's involvement regardless. Even if for some reason he can't, you know, he can't get something done, you know, in 2 weeks, I would rather have the book late and I know that makes retailers and people itchy, but
you know, you're saying the same thing they said about Civil War. It's the same damn story.
Yeah, but I think their concerns were a little different there. They just see, the thing about Civil War is they could crap that out. They knew that was going to sell regardless. So I don't mean they crapped it out. That was the incorrect phrase.
Kind of crapped out at the end, but I can say that, you can't.
I'm still not sure why the world's smartest men would unleash an untested Thor clone on the world, but
there are a whole lot of problems.
It's a whole other issue, but no. Yeah, I mean, I know that we're never going to get rich on the sales of the individual book. I do want to try to figure out a way to, you know, I've been thinking about maybe doing like an original story or an original storyline and just publish it as a trade or a graphic novel instead of doing single issues. You know, I've got somebody right now working on issue 11, But issue 7 isn't done. And, right. You know, and issue 6 is done, but Steven's finishing up issue 5 right now. So it's, you know, I mean, we're going to get it out there, and there are fans of the book who are really devoted to it. You know, God bless them for having the patience to stick around. But at the same time, I also am aware that long term, I'm always going to have the first trade, the second trade. We've solicited a third trade for August. That stuff is always going to be there. So, you know, someday when somebody who got frustrated trying to wait for the book on a monthly basis in 2004 gets a chance to, you know, pick up a trade and put it on his bookshelf, you know, hopefully they'll forget about those frustrations and just have the book on hand, you know. I mean, ultimately, I just want to make sure that it exists in some form. And you know, and I just got sent a really positive review from a writer on a book blog that was from yesterday or the day before of the first trade paperback, you know. So, you know, obviously he just discovered it, and hopefully a few people within that circle, which is different from the comics community, might give it a shot. So, you know, it's always out there, and there are always new people discovering it. So, and if some chance we ever make any traction in Hollywood with it, then, you know, the material will be there too, and more people will discover it. So
that's what's cool about the trades.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Forever. I mean, that's, yeah. Yeah. So ultimately I just want the work out there.
And, 76, is that we gonna
76, the next issue's out next week. Okay. You know, that's again, one of the hazards of doing a lot of this creator owned stuff is that we do so much of it ourselves in terms of the production and the lettering and putting it together. And, you know, we were 5 issues ahead of schedule or before we even did the first issue. And you know, we've had some circumstances that are going to put us behind the eight ball a little bit for the last 3 issues. And the other thing is we've got 2 separate creative teams working on the book. So, you know, one story, you know, we have to wait for both stories to get finished before we can do it. So, ultimately, again, that's a book that it's not selling in the singles all that well. And I knew that it probably wouldn't just because of the subject matter. It's black and white. And the 2 artists, Ty Walker and Ed Tatum, are phenomenal talents, but nobody knows who they are.
Right.
This is the book that I think ultimately when it's collected and we put some promotional weight behind collecting the series, I would expect more people to kind of look at what these guys are doing and say, wow, you know, these aren't like emerging talents with potential. These are guys who are already, you know, 5 issues into it doing work that stands on a par with just about anything in the industry.
Do you think you'll collect it as one volume, or you'll keep the 2 stories together?
I actually think we may do 2 volumes. Mm-hmm. I think we may do – because the way it works, it's an 8-issue miniseries. And my story with Ed is called Jackie Karma, which is set in New York in 76. And then Seth Peck and Ty Walker's story is Cool, which is set in Los Angeles in the 70s. Since it's 8 issues, the way it basically works is we end up with 2 4-issue miniseries worth of material. Mm-hmm. So I think it might make more sense to sort of tie them together but release them separately. Mm-hmm. And then let the properties kind of stand on their own. And maybe do a preview of, you know, maybe a chapter of Jackie Karma in the back of Cool and a chapter of Cool in the back of Jackie Karma, something like that. But we do plan on really putting together see, one of the things is there's not like a lot of sales momentum on the book that's pushing us to get a trade out right away.
Yeah, sure.
So I think we're going to step back and take some time and put together the best packages we can with as much promotion as we can. Because it is a book that the people who have actually read the thing really dig it. And you know, it's a niche thing. It's a crime
book.
It's 70s crime action. So I mean, you know, I've seen some reviews of it that you know, I mean, I read a review that said, I don't really get what's cool about the 70s, and I'm like, well, then stop reading the book, because it's, you know, I mean, I think the stories are really cool. They don't have to exist in the 70s, but at the same time, that's part of the vibe of the book, you know. I mean, hopefully you'll get that. So anyway, but yeah, I think we may end up doing 2 trades.
All right. And then I see here you're going to work with Tony Harris.
Yeah, that's and there's not a lot to talk about with that yet, but I know that Tony has posted. Tony's not like the most internet savvy guy in the world, so he's got a MySpace page that I don't think anyone knows exists, but he's got a blog on the MySpace page, and he's actually posted some original concept sketches of it, and he's posted the title, which is The Further Adventures of the Whistling Skull. And it's that book's probably, obviously, he's finishing up War Heroes and Ex Machina. Mm-hmm. And I think he finished up his Spider-Man commitment. So we're probably looking at, you know, another year or so down the road. But this is a, without giving a whole lot away, it's got a real pulp feel to it. And it's a project that Tony actually brought to me with kind of the basics in place, knowing that I was, you know, that's kind of a vibe I was into. And we spent a good year just kind of kicking around and hashing it out before we talked to the publisher.
Where does that dude find the time?
Sorry. Yeah, I hit the mute button there. Sorry.
Yeah.
Before we actually brought it to a publisher, and so we're not even really talking about the publisher yet or anything, or what the plans are for it. But it's a creator-owned book, and it's, you know, ultimately we'd love to have a nice healthy run of it. So it's a lot of fun. It's something that, even though it's something Tony's had in his, you know, the basics of in his mind for a long time, it's so much up my alley. And Tony is a guy who's Starman is sort of one of the seminal influences on everything I do. Mm-hmm. And so to work with Tony on a project that's real personal like this has been kind of a thrill.
Yeah.
And then I'm doing a book called Casey Blue Beyond Tomorrow at Wildstorm, the second issue of which came out yesterday, which is unrelated to the Wildstorm universe, but it's a crazy kind of teenage girl. The story basically opens with this teenage girl visiting her brother downtown and then walking into a stranger's apartment and beating him to death with her bare hands. And she's kind of curious why this happened. She doesn't remember doing it, but she knows because she's completely covered in blood that she did do it. And then things start happening around her, and she realizes there's a bigger picture involved, and it turns into a much larger sort of science fiction, slightly mystery adventure, which it may have flown below the radar of a few people, but I'm pretty happy with it. It's a little different than what I'm used to doing. I mean, I don't do a lot of teenage girl stuff, aside from the way I dress. And the artist is Carlo Barb. My wife is over here scowling at me.
Yeah, you're not going to get past that one, by the way.
This is not amused at all. It's nice to have a tough audience in the house, though. It makes you work harder. Carlo Barbary is doing the art, which is, again, kind of a style I've never really worked with before. But the people who are checking the book out seem to really be into the mystery and kind of digging it. So it's six issues to start with, and hopefully it's received well enough that maybe we can sort of expand on her story a little bit.
And it just stands on its own as a series outside of the Wildstorm
universe. Yeah.
So like Ex Machina or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a company. It's not a creator-owned book, but I developed it with Ben Abernathy. He kind of gave me some ideas, and we developed it together. So, but yeah, I mean, I hope people check it out. It's a little different, but it's fun. And then beyond that, I'm doing a graphic novel at Oni called Billy Smoke, which should be out next year with artist Eric Kim. It's a Hitman thing. I just wrapped up the JSA Classified arc, which I know people think of these stories as just sort of throwaway stories in the middle of these anthology books, but I would really like to encourage people to seek out the JSA Classified stuff Ramona and I did. It's a Wildcat story that we were kind of given the task of trying to tell a story that could act as a springboard for like a future direction for Wildcat. And they let me bring Ramon in, and he's just a phenomenal artist. Mm-hmm. And I'm really happy with the way that turned out. And I knew it would get kind of lost in the shuffle because of the type of book it is. But I've had so much reaction to that from people who were like JSA or Wildcat fans who were just kind of expecting just another throwaway story that I like to kind of highlight it because I'm extremely happy with the way that one turned out. Dave McCaig did the color and it's beautiful. But Bo Smith just did this great review of, and Bo Smith has written some Wildcat miniseries here and there. And on his Busted Knuckles column, he wrote this insanely flattering review of the story arc and drew some more attention to it. So anyway, I mean, I don't want to make too big a deal out of a three-issue story arc in this larger anthology book, but I am pretty proud of that, and I'd love people who are fans of the Golden Age characters or Wildcat or the JSA to check it out and let me know what they think of it. So,
well, I mean, it's always cool to find a gem in a series like that, which is, you know, to be it can be not sensational. So yeah, like everyone's like, oh, there was a really great story in there, and Wildcat's a great character, and obviously there's a lot of love for the JSA. So,
Right. And the thing about Bo's review that I you know, here I am attacking reviewers and then I'm promoting reviews. But the thing about Bo's review that I appreciated.
Didn't want to say anything.
Well, but the thing is, but see, this is where, I mean, I get to pick and choose reviews as the creator because I can say, hey, look, this guy responded. I've read good reviews of my work that I've dismissed completely because I'm like, you know, the comparisons they make don't make sense. They missed what I was going for. But Bo kind of nailed exactly what we were trying to do with this and responded the way we hoped people would respond. So it was really gratifying to see a guy who, you know, I don't have any personal relationship with Bo, but to see a guy who's written the character and, you know, is the kind of also reader that we hope to connect with, really connect with the story, is pretty satisfying. So that's the thing. If you're writing a book and you get positive reviews that sort of get what you're going for, then you know that at least on some level you've succeeded for those people. And so that's why it gets disheartening when people who just don't connect with it dismiss it. You know what I mean? That's kind of, I think, kind of where it all comes apart or together. Mm-hmm. Or whatever.
And you're still not done with your list of stuff that's coming.
Oh, what else? Let's see.
Blue Jacket with Seth Peck.
Oh, yeah, Blue Jacket, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Seth Peck and artist Chris Samnee, who just did a fantastic issue of Daredevil.
Chris Samnee, or is it Samnee?
Oh, it's Samnee, yeah.
I mean, that's a guy I want to see more and more from, definitely.
Yeah, he's one of these guys that's just it's a crying shame he's not doing more and more mainstream stuff so people can see his work. But he'll get there. I mean, I think he's doing something else for Marvel now, and he just did this Daredevil story with Andy Parks writing.
I just actually finished my copy of Truman in Capote in Kansas.
Oh, is that not a great book? Did you enjoy the book?
Oh, yeah, it was fantastic. And I mean, I enjoyed that book a lot more than I did the movie. I didn't really connect with it, but like that was a gorgeous book.
No, yeah, I agree. That was the first thing that Chris really – that's how I got to know Chris, because Andy's a friend. And Andy had written Union Station at Oning, which I enjoyed. But, right. You know, this is one of those cases where I read Capote in Kansas, and I it's where you have to tell a friend, listen, I know I would tell you I like this book even if I really didn't, but I really, really like this book, you know. I thought that was one of the best.
It's one of those things – every time that I see a book that is really good but is not what people think of as a comic book, I get very excited.
Right.
Like, here's a thing that –
yeah,
most people don't know you can do.
Yeah, well, and I think not to shill a whole bunch, but another book that I don't know if you guys have reviewed much or talked about, but Chris and Brian Hurt are good friends, and Brian Hurt and Colin Bunn have done The Damned at Oney, which I think is the best book on stands right now, mm-hmm. and the first trade paperback is just fantastic. Brian Hurt is another guy who's just he's so much better than almost anybody out there, and I just wish more people could be exposed to the work these guys are doing. But you know, they don't really fall into easy categories. You know, they're not really working they don't work in styles that are necessarily going to hook into the wizard audience. But they're just such great artists. So Chris, let me get back to Blue Jacket. Chris had asked me about doing something together because he'd been doing a lot of like Queen and Country. He did an Exterminators fill-in. He did Checkmate, and he was getting a little tired of doing like these real world based stories. Mm-hmm. But because that's what he had always done, that's kind of how he'd been pigeonholed.
Sure.
And Seth and I had been kicking around this Blue Jacket idea, which is kind of like – it's like Doc Savage meets Donald Trump kind of which actually CBR came up with that. But basically Blue Jacket is an adventurer who's been around for about 70 years, and this corporation has kind of risen around him. So it's sort of taken him out of his original element, which was out in the field kicking butt with his men of adventure. And the first larger story we have involves like complications in the business world that forces him to go back out in the field. We've had this story idea around for a while and some concept sketches, and I showed it to Mark Waid, and Mark told me about this Pulp Tales anthology that Boom is doing to benefit Josh Schmedors, and he said, you know, I think this would be a perfect place to showcase this because the idea behind the story is it's like you jump in the middle of a pulp story and then you either get resolution or just a part of the story and then entertain people along the way. And he thought Blue Jacket had enough of a pulp feel to kind of fit. So, you know, we saw Steve Niles and Josh Fyoklov and Andy Bees doing the art on Josh's story, and Ben Templesmith did the cover. You know, these are guys I know and like and knew they would do some cool work, and it's obviously a good cause.
Josh was a Xenoscope creator, and he had back surgery, I think it was?
He was diagnosed with cancer, mm-hmm. And he, like a lot of freelancers, didn't have any insurance,
right.
And pretty serious. And I haven't seen the latest updates on his condition, but it was you know, potentially life-threatening. Mm-hmm. And so the community kind of rallied around him, and because so many guys could see themselves in that position, you know, lent a helping hand. So we, you know, we when like I said, when Mark told us about the idea that we could introduce our character and hang on to all the rights and everything and just let people kind of get a dose of Blue Jacket, we decided to climb on board. And we finished our story, and I think it's going to be out in I think – is it August? I think it's either July or August. I'm not sure when it's going to be out, but I've seen most of the book, and it's a pretty cool little package.
And then on top of all this indie stuff, you have a story coming out in Marvel Comics Presents. That's the last thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I totally forgot about that. Yeah. I wrote a Stingray story like 2 years ago.
I have no idea who that character is.
Stingray?
I can't
what?
Think of it. I can't pick. Listen, maybe I'm not as big of a comic book nerd as you.
Well, it's possible. The reason I picked Stingray is because at the time I knew he was probably not involved with Civil War and all this other stuff. Of course, right after I wrote the story, I started seeing these like Avengers promo ads with Stingray up front, but he's like a water character. He's got like the thing about him is his costume is really cool. He's got like this red and blue, or not red and white costume with like kind of water wings and a white mask that he, you know, I don't know. He was a Submariner villain, and he was briefly an Avenger in like the late 80s, early 90s. And hadn't been doing a whole lot lately, but I've always dug the character. I tend to like the obscure characters more than the super popular characters. And Warren Simons is the editor, and he was kind of asking me to pitch some stuff, and that was just an idea I pitched. It's just kind of a fun little throwaway story, but cool. Lee Weeks is doing the art, which is pretty cool because he's awesome, and the story looks great, and it's, you know, I guess it's out in July. I think number 12, Marvel Comics Presents number 12. So that's the up to date. That's the only Marvel work that I've done that panned out like it was supposed to. So I haven't really dealt much with Marvel for a while, but it'll be kind of fun to see that come out. So,
all right, well, I guess people are going to be disappointed we didn't fight.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I mean, next time I'll call you names. But
here
I'll
go got all oiled up, but then you showed up dressed like a teenage girl, and I just couldn't go through.
Well, I mean, I'm just, you know, I wasn't looking to pick a fight or make waves. I was just, you know, grew frustrated with some of the stuff I saw, made a comment, and then a whole bunch of people responded to it. So, but no, I think it was a good discussion. It was a good chance to kind of chat.
Very cool. Yeah, I had fun.
And people, by the way, the blog, I don't like publicize my blog a whole lot, but if people want to drop in to the blog, I do update it. It's bclaymore.blogspot.com, and I have a message board at the Image Comics board too. So I will periodically drop these, you know, knee-jerk comments that people can feel free to flame me over on the Bendis board or whatever. So
let's have some more 3 a.m. rants.
Yeah, that's usually about when they come.
Listen,
so,
it works out better for all of us.
There's a lot more stuff that I start to type and go, "What? That would be really stupid," and then delete.
I do that a lot.
But I appreciate you giving me the chance to kind of chat and also my email address is bclaymore@aol.com. If anybody wants to drop me a line or comment about anything, I'm open to any mail from people. So
anything
I'm very accessible.
You can do to get out of writing all this work.
That's right, and I'll be in Chicago next week too. So Jeremy Hahn and I'll be sharing table space back in Artist Alley with close to Mike Norton and some other guys. So come out and say hi and tell me
stuff.
I'm an idiot.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Josh.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also like, one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com/iFanboy.